This episode is brought to you by GeekAid. What's your geek? Hello, hello, all you fine comic book fans out there in internet land. My name is Jordan Hazelwood, and I'm across the sofa from my good friend and colleague, Mr. Brendan Michelli, and we welcome you to your third visit to the Nonstop Comic Shop, where we always have issues. Brendan, how's the stay find you?
Not too bad. Doing good here. How about you?
I'd like to say I'm feeling pretty good, although I am going to be delving into a topic that I gotta say I have some personal grief with. I may have mentioned before that I'm still really very much in a Spider-Man kind of mood. I'm so jazzed that Spider-Man is in some way a part of the MCU again. Not quite as jazzed as the box office has been, admittedly, but pretty jazzed nonetheless, right?
Yeah.
So there are a bunch of Spider-Man-like stories that I've been holding on to for years, and I'd love to share with you folks now. Although this is admittedly kind of a sore spot for me. I suppose it's very common among fans of any kind of, you know, continuous media to maybe single out the occasional supporting cast member, you know, not a major player in the ongoing story per se, but you still can't help but feel for the person and hope that you know, he or she gets a little bit more play in the future. You'd like to see, you know, more done with him or her.
Yeah.
Well, that absolutely happened to me the first time I laid eyes on one Captain Gene DeWolf, who is a minor player in a large swath of Spider-Man comics that I... classic Spider-Man comics from the mid-70s to the mid-80s that I read in, you know, essential Marvel format, of course. I'd like to take this episode, if I may, to kind of walk the folks at home through the dizzying highs of the character's introduction. I mean, they're not dizzying highs. They're still up there, but... and then the horrible crashing lows of the end of her particular story. I have a lot of comics to cover, so I'm going to do my best.
I'm sitting here with three. Not one, not two, but three Marvel Essentials sitting here with bookmarks in them that, you know, for today's episode. So get yourself a cup of coffee or a mug of cocoa and put your feet up, because I think we're going to be here for a while.
Well, so without much further ado, I first met Captain Gene DeWolf in the absolute last place I ever expected to find anything good, Marvel Team-Up. the Marvel Team-Up series, which I believe there are four volumes of which in essential format, is much like the Marvel 2-in-1 series that I spoke about at length at the final episode of our previous show, but as a refresher, the Marvel Team-Up and Marvel 2-in-1 series, they star Spider-Man and The Thing, respectively, who were among the biggest characters that Marvel had in their stable at the time, and these books seemingly existed just to hash out the crappiest stories that anyone had ever came up with, just as long as they team up with some random other hero who's nowhere near as popular enough to carry their own books.
Yeah.
And I really chafed. I really suffered under the slavish devotion to awful formula that these books exhibit. It was a slog getting through these, and I got through them, I guess, just because I wanted to, you know, I wanted to cover my bases. I'm that much of a Marvel historian. But starting with Marvel Team-Up number 48, and continuing until issue number 51, which that alone is quite an achievement, because just about every issue of Marvel Team-Up is a one-shot. Mm-hmm. There's barely enough story to cover four pages, let alone 20. But this one was actually, this was an arc, somewhat serious arc. So even without the introduction of Our Lady Jean DeWolf, that would have been enough to at least capture my interest. But in any case, the story begins with Spidey just kind of swinging through the sky, and the shot is dominated by some kind of gigantic oil silo that has Tony Stark's name plastered on it. And oh no, what should be approaching the giant oil silo but a radio-controlled toy plane that drops an adorable little bomb.
Oh my God!
This is a silo.
The guy drawing this must never have actually seen a plane that carries a bomb, because it's got the bomb sideways. It's carrying the bomb sideways in its landing gear instead of, you know, flush against the fuselage in a bomb cradle. It's like the landing gear have been replaced. There's no wheels. There's feet, and the feet, like bird feet, are clutching this bomb sideways. I'm like, that's like deliberately more complicated than it needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know they didn't have the internet when this comic was made, but you know what they did have? Revell model kits in every hobby store in America. Go find a fucking torpedo bomber from World War II and draw a picture of it, dude.
Needless to say, the oil silo detonates with the force of a goddamn A-bomb and, like, fires Spidey halfway across Long Island. So, already, the story is about a mad bomber who uses radio-controlled little toy vehicles, which was also a major element of one of my favorite episodes of Batman the Animated Series.
Yeah.
Where we learned that Batman was inspired by the pulpy, TV exploits of the Grey Ghost, who was played by Adam West. That came out in, like, late 1991. I'd like to imagine the Rob Liefeld pen Deadpool also saw that episode and said, oh, so that's what metatextuality is like. Maybe I should start using that. Don't get me wrong. I still kind of like this story. It's not good, but it kind of starts at a bad foot when it's like, hey, remember that thing from that episode you really like? Well, we're doing it again. Isn't that great?
Yeah, it's
something of a pet peeve of mine, but moving on. Of course, Iron Man happens to be flying by, and so he plucks Spidey out of the sky, and, you know, Spidey, they touch down in a graveyard, and Spidey talks about about what happened. And Iron Man, standard operating procedure for Marvel team-up stories, takes this information and accuses Spider-Man of being the Mad Bomber, and starts to move to put his ass down. Like I said, in all Marvel team-up issues, when the two heroes meet, they immediately come to blows and usually suspect each other as being the villain of the piece, even though that never, ever, ever, ever is true.
Yeah, it's like, how many times has Spider-Man and Iron Man fought on the same side? In fact, you know, Spider-Man calls out, like, dude, I saved your life from, like, these three supervillains. Why am I the Mad Bomber? Because the script says we have to fight, dude.
So, just as my eyes are reaching maximum roll, who should come to my rescue but that Angel of Mercy herself, Police Captain Jean DeWolf. She just shows up in the background, basically puts both these guys in their corners, and starts talking about the real issue of the Mad Bomber at hand. So, Ms. Jean DeWolf, she has a bit of a predilection towards the 1930s. You'd say, I believe her Wikipedia page says that Bill Mantlo, her creator, imagine her as like a Rule 63 version of a hero you'd see in a Dashiell Hammett novel.
I can totally see that.
She's got a pencil skirt, one of those Andy Cap caps. What were those caps called? I think I've asked this question before.
I don't think it's a flat cap. I think it's a beret, because she's wearing it like at an angle on her head.
Mm-hmm. And fishnets, and she strikes a somewhat alluring but equally intimidating sort of posture.
And she never stops smoking.
And so, you know, she mentions this, you know, the Mad Bomber has been sending, your standard issue criminal letters warning people of the bombs that are made out of, like, magazines, they're cutouts from magazines.
Yep.
And then she produces the plane that dropped the bomb, which, how the hell that survived the A-bomb blast is beyond me, but what also survived were the backup C4 that was in the plane as it immediately detonates and nearly kills everyone.
Yeah.
They built RC toys their last back in the 70s, wouldn't you agree?
Yep. The plane remote remains are booby-trapped, so of course Spider-Man has to leap to save Jean DeWolf from the bomb. Iron Man can soak the blast, because, mm-hmm. Powered armor.
Also, he was kind of a dick earlier, so...
Yeah, like, this is for you blaming me for being the Mad Bomber, asshole. Take the blast.
So, needless to say, Captain DeWolf deputizes the two dudes, and they make tracks back to her police precinct house. And I scoured Google Image Search for a picture of this quasi-splash page, but I remember this panel vividly of Jean DeWolf... hitting the road in her Studebaker Roadster that has Spider-Man is like hanging out the
vintage.
Passenger side.
Yeah, this thing is 1930s at the latest.
It's like imagine a Model T, and imagine that looking as badass as humanly possible, and that's what we have here. And I do love how Spider-Man is, like, hanging out the passenger side window like a dog. And Iron Man is in flight, barely seeming to keep up with the Studebaker.
Yes.
And I looked at this panel and I just said, Gene, welcome home. I don't know what... I guess it helped that I read this back in, like, 2005 when, A, I was reading Marvel Team-Up and was used to disappointment. So this seemed really, really stellar in comparison. And two, I guess it also helped that I didn't know what a hipster was yet. Is she kind of hipstery to you? I mean, she doesn't wear fedoras or, you know, Coke bottle glasses or anything, but still. She has this retro chic... That honestly, it works for her.
Yes, but she's not rubbing the retro chic in everybody's face. So you could get a hipster vibe from her, but it doesn't. It's not quite that bad because, like I said, she's not rubbing the retro in everyone's face. You're not lording it over people. She's just chain smoking like a Bristol chimney.
So of course she arrives at the precinct and has to have some words with Death Sergeant Misogyny.
Mm-hmm.
Who, as again, this came out like 1976 or so, and like every other line of dialogue is like, isn't it weird that a woman is in charge of policemen? And so this guy who has probably worked for her for months is the first to say like, ooh, look at little Miss Sunshine over here, they're daughter of the former police commissioner, which is the only reason she got this job, bossing around dudes, am I right? And so she busts him down to beat cop, and he's like, why?
What did I do? You were a raging misogynist asshole. So, it's the 70s. Yeah, you have to spell those things out to people, I guess.
So in her office, and this is such a great window at what I guess the standard level of technology was at this time, because she mentions that she had to call in a favor from Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., to get Bleeding Edge, Kirby, you know, crackly... technology in order to have a desk projector to watch closed-circuit security camera footage on.
Oh, not just that.
On a policeman's salary.
It's been keyed up, so when she turns the projector on, it automatically turns the lights off in the office. I'm sure that's what she had to go to S.H.I.E.L.D. for the technical expertise to hook the switch up.
Again, I did some research. VCRs have been commercially available since 1972. But anyway, so she has all this security footage of here is the home of a wealthy slumlord that was bombed into oblivion by a cute RC toy car. And next slide, please. Here is a crowded bank, which was, again, you know, detonated by an RC toy plane. But there always seemed to be this mysterious hooded figure in the background that even though he walked among swarms of cops, no one remembers he was there. Ooh. So where could this mysterious figure be? And then the mysterious figure attacks the police precinct.
Yeah, he's like across the street.
Hey.
I do want to point out one thing is she's got the footage of the house, the slumlord's house that was destroyed, and she's got footage from a news camera because a cameraman showed up with the police when they initially got there, and it shows the remnants of the toy plane that blew the house up. It's self-destructing when a bunch of guys are around. It's like,
oh,
she
yeah,
knows they're booby-trapped,
yeah,
so of course she decides to show up with the booby-trapped remains of the plane to get Spider-Man and Iron Man's attention and seems surprised when it blows up in front of her. It's like, wait, you know these things explode. Why were you just hanging out with the unexploded but booby-trapped remains of this one?
That's a good point. So our villain, the Wraith, throws a RC plane through her window, and then Spider-Man goes to take him down and end the first issue. The second issue is two-thirds of which is one long protracted fight scene, which I can easily summarize for you by saying what the Wraith can do is he gets into a wrestling match with Spider-Man, and he seems to, like, you know, pin Spider-Man helplessly beneath his iron grip, and when Spider-Man thinks about the hopelessness of the situation, the Wraith responds back saying, yes, your thoughts are quite right, Spider-Man. You are hopeless. Despite the fact that I don't have superhuman strength, I'm just casting the illusion in your mind that I do, and therefore you can't escape my grasp. Ha 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 ha.
If you know that he doesn't actually have the superhuman strength, can't you punch him now?
Well, it, apparently Spider-Man doesn't clue into that. Instead, he gets drawn further and further into a vivid waking nightmare about encroaching shadows and Iron Man turning into a demon and his own very death, which he then wakes up with back in the Wraith's non-superhuman grasp. And as Jean starts to lay down suppressing fire, Wraith just looks in her direction, and now Jean is psychically compelled to start unloading her service revolver into Spider-Man. So, let's review for a second, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
The Wraith has incredible psionic power of mind control, illusion casting, and telepathy. He is basically Jean Grey and Mastermind and the Purple Man all rolled up into one. Why does he need the remote control planes? Why doesn't he just, I don't know, drive up to these guys that he wants to kill, make them think that the world is now a writhing mass of centipedes until they panic and run into traffic? Or just say, hey, jump off a building. Like, you got it, boss.
I got a better question. Why is he writing threatening notes to them, warning them ahead of time? And why is he using official police stationery and cutting letters out of a magazine that's like the Stars and Stripes for New York City cops?
Well, that's clumsy foreshadowing, actually.
Okay.
But again, not really necessary for someone with the powers that he has, I feel.
Yeah. Just, you raise a very valid point.
Yeah.
I do want to say that the issue itself isn't actually all that bad, because, mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that he's screwing with Spider-Man's mind, if he didn't, like, reveal to Spider-Man exactly how he was doing it, thus making Spider-Man look like a chump for not going, wait, you don't actually have super strength, I just think you do? Well, then, since I know you don't, I'm going to punch you in the face now. You know, like, Iron Man gets knocked out by a blast because he tries to stop the bomb that was thrown into the Wolf's window from going off, so he gets knocked out. And Spider-Man is put through a nightmare hellscape, and then DeWolf gets put through one, and it's actually very effective as an issue if you can get past the point that the reveal of the villain's powers make the setup of the mystery completely nonsensical.
More or less, yeah. Eventually they scare the Wraith off, and they reconvene in the police precinct, and who should also arrive but Papa Philip DeWolf. You know, as previously established by Sergeant Misogyny, the ex-police commissioner, who comes in and just starts throwing shade and family drama on you know, his dear daughter's meteoric rise to the rank of captain, which is a position that your brother should have had because you are a woman and not a man, so you shouldn't be in police work. And then, of course, Jean fires back of, well, it's a moot point, isn't it, Father, because Brian is dead! Dead! And then Papa DeWolf is like, well, you might think that, but how do you explain this letter that arrived for me this morning? And we never actually see the letter, but yeah. Let me just try to summarize the gist of what I think the letter says. It says, hi, fellow DeWolfs, it's me, Brian, the dead one. I'm really jealous of the fact that my sister has the job that was meant for me, which is why I now intend to systematically destroy her and everything she holds dear. Well, I'm pretty busy being dead and all, so I guess it's goodbye for now. You know, with love, Brian the Wraith DeWolf. P.S. Having a dick is awesome. Jean doesn't believe that Brian is alive, and Papa DeWolf is like, oh, but ghosts do not write letters to the living. That is only something you see in crappy dime novels and occasionally Silent Hill games. So, goodbye now. You know, of course, Spidey and Iron Man, you know, sneak in having overheard this exchange, and so Jean starts unpacking what happened to her dear brother. That while she was just about to graduate from the police academy, patrolman Brian DeWolf, who doesn't share the, her father's outdated, attitudes towards gender mores, was just a patrolman, and he was on patrol with his partner, Tim, who has, like, all of two lines, but my God, does he use those two lines to establish, beyond a shadow of a doubt, how Irish he is.
Yeah, like, wow, it's like, really
we have
bad.
We have a call down at the docks, laddie. Let's go, boyo. Oh, no, we're being ambushed.
Boyo.
Boyo.
Yeah, like literally.
Oh, I've been shot right in the stereotype. Brian, don't let them get my lucky. Gangsters with Tommy guns just light up their squad car, and they never found what happened to Brian's body. So they assume that he was killed in the attack, but there was no proof. So maybe he is still alive and has just gotten really sweet psionic superpowers and is blowing up random people now.
Car accidents do lead to psychic powers. I'm pretty sure that's something somewhere that I saw.
It's as good an explanation as they give.
Yeah.
But anyway, so thus, you know, we have a new mystery afoot. End issue 2. With the promise of my man, Doctor Strange, being part of the gala 50th issue of Marvel Team-Up, my new favorite comic.
Oh, so Spidey kicks Iron Man to the curb and hooks up...
No, actually, Iron Man is still in this, which, again, that's pretty rare with your Marvel Team-Ups.
Yeah.
That's our only strength. We have a new, also-ran, non-Spider-Man dude in every issue, but... No, they're really, you know, Bill Mantlo is really trying hard to have a cohesive thread through these books. It's not the most cohesive thread I've ever seen, but, you know, it's better than the usual. So, I'm going to be jumping around here a bit, but, Gene DeWolf and Iron Man are investigating this mystery on different angles. Iron Man looks at the Wraith's letter underneath a basic light microscope you would see in a middle school science lab. And discovers, haha, a fingerprint. The police sure aren't trained to trace fingerprints, unlike billionaire industrialists like myself. So, of course, he just hits his big old database of fingerprints and finds that it's a match with Philip DeWolf, Gene's father. Dun, dun, dun. The letter was delivered to his house. What?
Yeah.
And then Gene remarks, hey... When I picked up that toy, the toy plane that detonated at the very beginning of this, despite the fact that, as you pointed out, she should have expected that already, I didn't realize I was standing right next to the DeWolf family crypt. Maybe the plane detonated to scare me away from there. You know, the plane that flew across Long Island in the blast? Detective work!
Yeah.
They all are kind of, sort of, more or less heading in the right direction, but then Spider-Man taps Doctor Strange, and they go back to the scene of Brian's ambush, and Doctor Strange is like, I wield the magic of psychometry, and I can just summon the spirits of bygone years to tell me exactly what happened here the night of the ambush, and I'm like, well, thanks for rendering actual detective work completely moot there, Doc. I love you, but, you know, word to the wise, if you're ever in, like, I don't know, a tabletop role-playing game where someone has the psychometry power, just don't bother giving them mysteries.
Yeah.
Hey, lamppost, where were you on the night of August 19th? And the lamppost is like, well, I was here. Also, Philip DeWolf is the Wraith.
Yeah. it's like, yeah, I got psychometry. I can tell you exactly what happened. I can tell you that... The pacing in this is kind of bad because Spider-Man and Doctor Strange see that Philip DeWolf was involved in the shootout where Brian got killed and he carries him off. That's the page before Tony Stark finds the fingerprint.
It's like,
shouldn't we find the fingerprint first because it's not conclusive proof? Because if we've been paying attention, because that would work as a red herring. You know, if you've been paying attention, he handled the letter himself, so of course his fingerprints would be on it. That's why you take exclusion prints. When you dust, you know, a crime scene, so that you don't, you know, find a false positive, so you do the fingerprint first. But no, we've done the psychometry. We already know the solution, so we kind of just don't even need Tony Stark to see the fingerprint. Like, well, actually, we kind of do. You know why? Because Spider-Man doesn't know that Tony Stark is Iron Man, so we can't call Tony Stark and say, we've solved the mystery, meet us at the DeWolf crypt, we got to punch the Wraith.
No, he'd still say, hey, Tony, we solved the mystery, tell your bodyguard, Iron Man, that we don't need his help. But regardless, I guess the lamppost, after telling them that it was Papa DeWolf that took Brian's body, he also told them that he's been hanging out of the family crypt. So they go where Gene is, where Papa DeWolf and, well, actually it is Brian DeWolf who is the Wraith. And so he just, Papa DeWolf just asked Brian to cause stone hands to come out of the wall and batter Spidey and Doctor Strange senseless, which he does. And so, naturally, when they wake up, they are strapped to a table, and Papa DeWolf tells the two heroes and Gene, okay, so here's my, you know, my entire backstory and my evil, evil plan. Because this is the other thing that I've seen in every single issue of Marvel Team-Up. Like, I'm going to tell you, heroes, everything there is to know about this story until you get bored and just wrench yourself free from that table and kick my ass. So here goes. When Papa the Wolf found Brian's body, he was essentially in a persistent vegetative state, and so, not knowing what else to do, he called up his two richest buddies, one Mr. Max Vorster, the slumlord, and wealthy banker Carl Bonn. And he said, "Hey guys, you're both fantastically rich. Can you build a machine that can bring my boy back to life and also hopefully give him superpowers so that he may become like onto a wraith and visit justice on the wicked?" That's kind of what my plan is now. So Vorster and Bonn are like, "Well, we're extremely wealthy and this is a comic book, so yeah, of course we can do that." So they do. And they build a Frankenstein lab in the DeWolf family crypt. The machinery seems to consist of a giant fuck-off laser that's mounted to the ceiling, and that's just going to zap Brian back to life. Right as Papa DeWolf is about to flip the switch, this is when either Vorster or Bonn, I don't know which one exactly...
The one with the glasses.
It taps on Papa DeWolf's shoulder and says, "Hey, Phil, you got a minute? You're not busy, are you? Okay, so, well, what the other guy and I were saying... Instead of being a superhero, would you be receptive to the idea of having Brian do, you know, evil things? You know, rob grocery stores or burn down orphanages or something? We're really evil. I'm not sure if you've ever noticed that before." So, like, yeah, they tried to pressure him into becoming a criminal, and Phil's like, "That's exactly the opposite of what I intended to do. Have at thee." So the other two guys just push him into the laser, which... God, okay, what happens here? The laser joins Philip's brain with Brian. Brian's not alive per se, but he's basically a meat puppet that Philip can control mentally. So it's Brian who has all the sweet psionic powers, but it's Philip who has to think at him for him to use his sweet psionic powers.
That is way too damn complicated.
This is a little bit more micromanagement than I usually see in superpower media.
This is a revelation that only that they only had to do because in issue 2, they tell you the Wraith is Brian, so now they had to reveal that the Wraith wasn't, but the Wraith has to physically be Brian because of where he was during the fight and where, you know, Philip was. So they had to come up with some bullshit excuse why Philip is actually the Wraith, but it's physically Brian. Literally, this revelation is so complicated, you know, just because they give you a mystery with exactly one suspect.
Yeah.
And then needed to pad it out.
You know, I hope I've explained the streetlights confusion earlier.
Yeah.
So, just as Philip is in, you know, grand monologuing mode where he says that, you know, "That's why my first victims were the slumlord and the banker." And then Spider-Man, this is when Spider-Man's finally bored and he rips loose and he says, "Yeah, well, why the hell did you nuke that oil silo at the beginning, killing, like, untold hundreds, huh?" You know, just like that question from our first episode, how did she pass the psych evaluation? This is a question that will just never be answered.
Yeah, he's like, because he says, you know, "If you're trying to fight evil, then explain to me how blowing up the fuel tank, wiping out a bank full of innocent people, and attacking your own daughter works out to battling justice. You dare question my motives? You must be destroyed!" Okay, so we're not getting an answer. You're just fucking insane.
And,
is that what we're going
sure
with?
Gene said that the oil silo was the fifth attack, so there are two other attacks that she didn't even mention.
Yeah.
And will never be elaborated on. Maybe this isn't the best storytelling, I guess, but...
Having flipped through the rest of this book briefly, it still leagues better than what else is in here.
Yeah, I cannot possibly stress that enough.
Scarlet Witch versus Cotton Mather. Oh. A time-traveling witch finder. I mean, this is leagues more intelligent than that. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, thanks for reminding me of that, buddy. And then after that, then of course, Spider-Man goes to the future where he meets Killraven. And, oh god, the less said about Killraven, the better. So, moving on. So then Iron Man busts in with an alpha wave inhibitor, which is to say a big colander that he just slams on Papa DeWolf's head, and that severs his link to Brian. And, hooray! End of issue 3. you think it would kind of be over at this point, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, you've got a guy who's you've got a guy who's catatonic and can't do anything. Then you've got the mind controlly dude with the helmet on, so he can't make the catatonic guy do anything. And he's they're all arrested now.
And it was issue number 50, so perfect place to end a big swinging epic arc, right?
Yep.
Well, no, issue number 51 is the trial of the Wraith. So we open in a courtroom that has Iron Man and Doctor Strange presiding behind the defendants, and Papa the Wolf still has the colander on his head, and limp meat puppet Brian is there, still in costume but without the hood, just staring blankly from the bench.
He's in court. He's in court for his trial. Why don't they just put him in a damn suit? No, he's in his costume. He can't dress himself, Your Honor, and none of us wanted to do it for him. That's why he's still in his outfit. He's still wearing his underwear on the outside.
And man, this is a star-studded issue because J. Jonah Jameson is there as well, basically just to yell at Peter to get more pictures of the bereaved parties. And there's practically a whole subplot devoted to him just being a complete asshole that is barely worth commenting on. And so you're probably asking, well, if this is a courtroom in the Marvel Universe, where's Matt? Oh, there's Matt Murdock. He's in San Francisco, but they still have him Skyping in. And you might think, well, isn't that technology that we've already proven only S.H.I.E.L.D. has? Well, that's why S.H.I.E.L.D. is there. So they have both, they have a row of S.H.I.E.L.D. technicians controlling the AV equipment. So they have Matt Murdock and Colonel Nick Fury Skyping in for this trial of the century.
Yeah, because this was in the 70s. The Marvel Universe only had one attorney. So if you're having a trial, Matt Murdock has to show up.
We haven't created She-Hulk yet. She was 1980. So you might think, well, maybe it would be interesting to have a courtroom drama kind of issue. Well, no, because here's where Papa the Wolf just looks at this goateed S.H.I.E.L.D. technician dude whose name is Carter, and I only bring that up because that'll become important in the other four-issue arc I'm talking about later. So he basically just looks at this Carter guy and he says, Carter, I am in your mind. Remove the equipment that prevents me from exercising my mind control. Wait, what?
Well, he does state that the helmet is jamming his alpha waves, but it's not jamming the delta waves, so he's able to switch frequencies on his brain to mind control this dude.
Science, bitch!
Yep.
Mr. Carter, agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., unplugs the equipment, and then the Wraith is back on, baby. But in the immediate fracas, Papa the Wolf steps on the wire that Carter pulled out of the thing, and the electric jolt now turns him into the Wraith. Science, bitch, again! Like, I'm not even going to talk about the fight scene, really, although I do kind of like the bit where Papa the Wolf, in Brian's body, because he can also do that now when his first body is rendered unconscious, just so we're clear, he crafts an illusion, or maybe it's not an illusion, well, the floor gets up and takes the form of a floor golem and just starts wailing on all the superheroes in attendance. Oh, and J. Jonah Jameson picks up Peter's mysteriously discarded camera and tries to get a picture of this action, and he accidentally ejects the film out the back of a camera because he's never touched a camera in his life, apparently. Is there ever been a model of camera in which the giant round button in the upper right corner is not the shutter, but rather ejects the film?
Yeah. That's... I mean, come on, he should really know better.
I'm getting kind of bored of this story by this point.
Yeah, so we started off so well, and then we just got, like, really, really stupid here.
So both Wraiths are down, and then Doctor Strange takes his sweet time in across two whole pages to say, I shall psychically operate on young Brian DeWolf, and I will bring his soul back into his body, because I'm a doctor. So he does that. And so Brian is alive again, and he still possesses all of his awesome superpowers, but he is well within his faculties once again, just like that. So now the trial of the Wraith can continue. So in this courtroom that is basically a crater at this point,
There's still, yeah. It's like, well, the floor, you know, got up, attacked the people, had a fist fight. There were some
repulsor beams. You have the floor. You have the hole in the ground. And I do love how they don't really lead with a. It's almost like the Wraith is not even on trial in this trial of the Wraith. The judge is trying to prove the mere existence of psychic powers that could potentially mind control another person into doing crimes. Like, that's what's on trial here?
Yeah, they're trying to prove that it was actually Philip DeWolf controlling Brian's meat puppet body through psychic powers, so they gotta prove psychic powers are real. In the Marvel fucking universe, they have to prove this shit?
Apparently, and because there haven't been enough guest stars in this issue, well, they bring in character witness Charles Xavier, who says that, yes, in active mutant genes, psychic abilities are absolutely possible. Don't you remember that one movie where I broke into the White House and, like, psychically froze all of the president's staff and then coerced the president into knocking off his shit about mutants? I felt especially heroic that day.
Yeah, they even bust out Moondragon for a special appearance.
Yeah, Heather Douglas, a.k.a. Moondragon, who is also bald, so obviously she must know a lot about psychic powers, too.
Yeah.
A quick fun fact, guess who her father is?
I got nothing.
Drax the Destroyer.
That's right, in the actual comics, he's not an alien from space.
Well, he started as a human, and then he just kind of became an alien from space, yeah. Somehow. But, yeah, so I have a bad feeling we might not actually see Moondragon in the movies because she's canonically dead now, but oh well. We'll find another bald guy somewhere. And I know Fox obviously has the other one, but moving on. So, ultimately, the judge decides that we can't prove that psychic abilities exist, although it seems pretty obvious that Philip coerced Brian into doing shit, so... Brian, you're free to go. Papa, you get the chair. Case dismissed. Please,
we can't prove psychic powers are real. Despite the dust-up we fucking had in the courtroom with the psychic guy, we can't prove any of that actually happened. Despite the fact that S.H.I.E.L.D. was Skyping in at the time. Mm-hmm.
S.H.I.E.L.D., who, by the way, has an entire contingent of espers.
Yeah.
Extrasensory perception agents.
Oh, God. It's like... What the shit? This is like the dumbest single dumbest issue I have seen. It's like we need to prove the psychic powers. We have to argue that they're actually real. Somebody should say, well, for the point of proving psychic powers are real, I call everyone who was in this room 10 minutes ago to the stand. So what did y'all think when the floor sat up and tried to kick you in the head? Yeah, psychic fucking powers. So, I mean, I understand that they want to get case law settled, yeah. But Jesus Christ, people, the floor attacked you.
So outside of the courthouse, Jean tearfully welcomes Brian back into her life, and she's really hopeful that after a period of, you know, reacclimation with society, Brian will use his awesome powers for the good and justice of all. Boy, that doesn't happen. I'm not even going to get into how completely short-lived the Wraith's superhero career actually is. But, I should probably also mention that I guess they had a whole page that no one knew how to fill up. So a third of it is the Hulk just jumping across the desert to establish the fact that the Hulk will be in episode 52.
Yep.
Yay. But the...
He's jumping really, really silly-like.
Mm-hmm. But the second third of that page is the judge convening with his cabal of secret psychics saying... Boy, we sure dodged a bullet there in that courtroom. If I had proven that psychic powers existed, maybe people would expect me and my friends of being psychics. Ha 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 ha.
Yeah.
This had a point.
Yeah. Those three panels are easily the dumbest three panels I've seen in this entire book. Like, seriously, it's like I had to pretend that psychic powers weren't real because people might think I'm psychic if I say they're real. Why would they think that? People might think, wait, you think psychic powers are real? Oh, you're a character in the Marvel Universe. Well, obviously psychic powers are real. I mean, we had fucking Charles Xavier in the room. The floor tried to kill us.
Well, to be fair, we didn't know that he was Professor X until around the same time that Iron Man outed himself.
True, but they're calling him to the stand as an expert on psychic powers.
So needless to say, the story has some flaws.
It starts out promising, then it gets good, then it's good, but it erases the promising origin, the promising opening, make the opening less intelligent, and then it ends perfectly fine. And then, much like Steven Spielberg's AI, it just keeps going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it ended pretty fine in the third of fourth issues.
Yeah.
Look, I'm still glad that this story happened because it gave us Gene DeWolf. Captain Gene DeWolf would become a major sporting player in a lot of Spider-Man books, as well as some Iron Man and some Ms. Marvel. And, you know, she is the friendly face in the New York City Police Department. You know, Spider-Man, of course, actually did have a friendly face in the New York City Police Department in the late 60s, that being another police captain, Captain George Stacy, as Gwen's dad. Well, Stan Lee invented him, and I think it was Stan's decision, you know, is this seeming kind of Commissioner Gordon-y to you? Like, should Spider-Man really have, you know, a staunch defender in the legitimate authority who is flagrantly misusing his authority to help a unknown mass vigilante? Is that really realistic? Like, we don't want to be DC.
Yeah.
Right? We don't want to be the distinguished competition. So that's why Stan killed him off. And I'll tell you a bit more about the death of George Stacy towards the end of this program. Because, well, I'm just going to go ahead and spoil it. Most of you comic book historians out there already know. Yeah, Gene DeWolf also is killed off. And I'm actually going to talk about that storyline once we come back from the break. But before I do, I have to mention, I feel like there was a reason why she was chosen to get taken out of the picture. Well, you see, the reason it was very much predicted by the wise words of the great sage of our era, Avril Lavigne. When she said, he was a boy, she was a girl, could it be any more obvious? So we take our break now, and when we come back, the proud conclusion of the Gene DeWolf saga. See you soon, folks.
Hey, folks at home. It's time once again for my mid-break pick of the day, where I draw your attention to another fine internet media product here on GeekAid.com. If you're anything like me, you just got back from a convention where you won 3 consecutive trivia challenges and you still haven't had your fill. That's why you'll be glad to hear about Stone Age Gamer number 163, E.T. Regret Shift, the latest in the long line of trivia episodes for GeekAid's premier podcast. D&D games, anagrams, Monopoly music, the hosts of You Shall Not Pass Go, plus how many Sonic games are there? All that and more on the most recent episode of the Stone Age Gamer podcast. And I did win those 3 trivia contests, as you can see from my $25 GameStop gift card that I'm holding up to the microphone. Pretty sweet, right?
And welcome back, folks. I don't mean to skip over all the good times, but I can't stress enough, I had enjoyed a good almost 8 years worth of comics, seeing Gene pop up in the margins and always being being a little more glad when I saw her. As I mentioned before, she would basically be Spider-Man's contact with the legitimate authority, and she was on hand to back up the superheroes, which is to say, basically be their valets and kind of clean up their messes. So,
yeah.
Actually,
thanks for punching all these criminals in the face without any concern for due process. We'll take it from here.
Mm-hmm. On occasion, she would really, stretch and show her chops. I was especially fond of a long stretch in the original Amazing Spider-Man book where the Black Cat, it was very shortly after the Black Cat was introduced, and became kind of a love interest, sort of against Spidey's wishes, remember that concept. We'll be revisiting that here in just a moment. But, but Black Cat was, trying to emulate her squeeze Spidey and try to be a hero, and got in between a gang fight between Dr. Octopus and the Owl. Leland Owlsley, the owl, who can fly for reasons, but although he was played by that evil prison warden from Shawshank Redemption in the Daredevil Netflix show, so I recommend that. He couldn't fly in that show, which is unfortunate because he fell to his death. Oops. Anyway. Black Cat is nearly killed in the crossfire, and so while she is convalescing in the hospital and is immobile, Dr. Octopus moves to finish the job, but Gene stands in his way and fends him off with a retinue of cops until, you know, the star of the show gets there and finishes the climactic battle. So I just always wanted to see more of Jean. I couldn't believe that there hasn't been an issue in which she's more or less the co-star, in which, you know, she gets a plot to herself. And when I read Spectacular Spider-Man number 83 for the first time, which in all honesty is a pretty good issue. It guest stars Cloak and Dagger, and it also features the trial of the Punisher, which is a way better trial than the Wraith got.
Yeah.
And was also largely adapted to yet another episode of the Netflix Daredevil show. You know, there's some good stuff in this issue. This issue that was written by Bill Mantlo, you know, Gene DeWolf's creator, but in her very brief scene that is a complete throwaway appearance otherwise, when Spidey swings away from his latest collar, you know, Jean muses to herself, oh, he's probably going back to, you know, to his girlfriend, the Black Cat. But, you know, looking at those buns, like, man.
That spider suit is very form-fitting.
Mm-hmm. If he ever gets tired of the Black Cat as she starts licking her finger out of the corner of her mouth, maybe he should swing my way sometime. I remember kind of vomiting in my mouth when I saw this.
She's expressed no interest in him in that style before, prior to this point.
No.
Just suddenly decided, wait, this character's female, she needs to want to bang Spidey.
You know, when Black Cat did this very same thing, we were already kind of established that Black Cat is not the most mentally sound person, and was already very much criminally inclined, and was also kind of a thrill seeker, so it sort of made sense when, you know, she fell hard for a guy who's not only on the opposite side of the law from her, but also a guy that she knows literally nothing about. So now when Captain Gene DeWolf does it after, like, what, 7 years of helping him on, you know, solve cases on the police force, it felt really goddamn creepy.
Yeah.
And it also doesn't help that Spidey and Black Cat are roughly the same age, and this is an issue with, like, every female character in comics, but the first time I saw Jean DeWolf, I placed her, like, being maybe around 40. Like, she mentioned that, you know, she'd been a cop for a long time, and then was in, like, detective school.
If she's a captain, she is not younger than 35.
Mm-hmm.
She is not younger than 35.
And Spidey's still in graduate school at this point.
Yeah, but she doesn't know
so,
that.
Right, but I do, unfortunately.
So she's a cougar. I mean, just, you know, it could be worse, I suppose.
Like, does anyone ever joke about Commissioner Gordon being in love with Batman?
They save all the gay jokes for Batman and Robin.
Yeah. I don't. This just felt so goddamn wrong to me. Just seeing her get all squishy at the sights of the sight of Spider-Man, who she's seen for 7 years, I found this abhorrent to the very core of my being. Am I just a prude? What do you think?
Well, you don't seem to have that much of an issue with Black Cat throwing herself at Spider-Man, so I guess you're probably not a prude. But I think the fact that it seems out of character for her is probably the issue.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Black Cat fell madly in love with Spider-Man at the end of her first issue.
Yeah.
So, look, you can debate my emotional state all you want, but let me hit you with some facts. No writer touched Jean DeWolf for about a year after this issue. And when she finally did come back in Spectacular Spider-Man, this was the issue where the issue of Spider-Man that had no Spider-Man in it because he was on the other side of the galaxy fighting the Secret Wars. It actually followed Black Cat, who had acquired superpowers from the Kingpin, but don't tell Spider-Man that, or he might think that she's, like, evil or something. So she's just trying to find Spider-Man. Where is Spider-Man? So she visits Jean DeWolf, and they have what's on the surface as a very professional conversation, but of course, Jean's side of the panel is replete with a bunch of thought balloons saying, like, oh, you lucky bitch, you know, you still have Spider-Man in your claws while leaving me here to have my schoolgirl crush and my, you know, damp knickers all alone to myself. And I'm like, oh, just, Al, stop. Just, ick. Yeah, you know, let's just fast forward to the fifth volume of The Essential Spectacular Spider-Man. So, I'm directing your attention, Brendan, to, I believe it's an annual, so the Spectacular Spider-Man annual number 5, which is a story about this young kid on a motorcycle named Ace, and he's grappling with teenage gang warfare, and it's all very thrilling and stuff, but I remember this issue with Jean's portrayal. At the crime scene, she stomps out of a cab, and she is wearing the most singularly ugly, sexy evening gown I've ever seen.
It's very 80s. It's literally the height
shoulder
of the
pads,
80s. Yes.
Baby. Also, I should probably mention that this issue is the artist. Hey, guess what, Brendan? I'm mentioning the art in one of these things now, for once.
Yep.
The artist, his name is Mark Beecham. I spoke about him before on my previous show once. I actually reviewed an issue that's like 6 issues downstream from this a little while ago that was also drawn by Mark Beecham. Actually, just last issue, I talked about Greg Land, and I could throw in other luminaries like Frank Cho or Jim Lee. And these are guys who you can make jokes that they got into drawing comic books for a living because they couldn't get as much money to draw porn.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember reading Batman Hush, and there's a scene where Harley Quinn, like, acrobatically robs an opera house or something, and I'm like, hey, Jim, how exactly is Harley performing these great feats of acrobatics and trapeze artistry without getting bludgeoned into unconsciousness by her giant pendulous breasts that are both larger than her head? Same goes for Frank Cho and, like, his Liberty Meadows stuff, or Shanna the She-Devil, and Greg Land, we've already mentioned. But yeah, you know, so you joke about how horn-tastic their depictions of the female form are.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to all their websites today. None of them ask if you're older than 18. Mark Beecham's does. So, yeah, his depiction of Our Lady, Jean DeWolf, is, like, all low angles, all basically, you know, cleavage and panty shots. There's a guy who is, like, he was being gurneyed into an ambulance. He was nearly stabbed to death. He will probably not survive the trip to the hospital, and he cannot stop talking about how goddamn foxy Jean DeWolf is. You sure you're a cop, lady? You're not a prostitute?
It's interesting. I'm looking at this guy's artwork, and honestly, it seems ill-fitting for a superhero comic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he really wants to be drawing a gritty, noirish crime comic.
Well, if you want that, you call Gene Colan, not this guy, but it's still...
But yeah, but his artwork's not bad. It just feels out of place for... Like, some of the faces, he tries to make them look very realistic, and so everyone's face is actually shaped differently, so you don't get, like, the same face you get in a lot of, you know, comics, where they're mostly focusing on the action. But I look at this, and I'm like, it doesn't look like he's good at doing action. Mm-hmm. He can draw someone standing still and make the picture really, really interesting. Someone standing still looking really interesting, but movement... It doesn't. His movement doesn't work, and when you're doing a superhero comic, it's all about movement, because people are going to be punching dudes real soon.
Mm-hmm. Well, I bring this up because, just Jean's depiction is very shallow in this issue. After everyone finally stops ogling her, Spider-Man starts to swing away, then swings back and saying, hey, I better get one more picture of Jean in that outfit without her consent, so I can, you know, jack off to this later. He basically says that. I'm paraphrasing slightly. And then Ace, you know, the guy from the cover, zips by in his motorcycle and practically yanks her skirt off as he passes. I bring all of this up, not just because I found it disgusting, but also because, guess what? This is the last we ever see Jean alive. Hooray, right? The very same month this came out, we also got Spectacular Spider-Man 107, issue one of the four-part Death of Jean the Wolf arc. Y'all ready for this? You know, I actually rather do like the first three pages of this issue, because it is narrated by Jean herself, and she walks us through, you know, walks us down memory lane about her story that was certainly hinted at in the very first arc. There wasn't much attention paid to it. She did mention that her parents got divorced because her father is a raging misogynist. Yep. And her mother got remarried to another cop.
It was this other cop who was much, much less of an asshole who seems to have formed her into the shining exemplar of Law and Order that she she is.
More or less. How often do you read a story about a character who likes her step-parents more than her actual parents?
Not a lot, especially not from this era.
This never-before-mentioned stepdad is a major influence to help her push past all the discomfort and all the stresses of, you know, of being a woman and entering a man's world. And she really hopes that she made the New York Police Department proud. But I'm not going to get any chance anymore because I am bleeding out my stomach from the crater that a dude's double-barreled breech-loading shotgun left while I slept last night. So, not sure how I'm narrating this to you. Sunset Boulevard was a good movie, wasn't it? Yeah, so goodbye. I didn't know what I was expecting, reading an issue about the death of Jean the Wolf. I didn't expect her to more or less be dead before the story started.
Yeah.
So I'm already not in a really great place right now. And then I turn the page and boobs!
Yeah? Yes. Wow, really?
amazingly enough, Mark Beecham is not the artist of this, but holy God, are these two pages exactly something you would see in Mark Beecham's oeuvre. So yeah, there's like two pages in which Peter says, oh boy, this is what I'll put on the front page of the Daily Bugle. This chick's boobs. I can just see the headlines now. Put them on the glass. Put them on the glass.
Doesn't this predate Sir Mix-a-Lot by a couple of years?
Probably. This is like 1984, I think, so...
I love Peter's next thought is, you know, if the Bugle won't take the photos of the girl's boobs, he can hang them up in the dark room as a decoration.
Go right next to my Jean DeWolf spank material from the previous issue. And he even mentions, this is another thing that I would expect to see in a Mark Beecham penned story, but he says, it's 40 degrees outside, and yet here's this woman in a mini blouse showing off her sweater puppies to all in attendance. Isn't that great?
Yeah. Like, it's 40 degrees in New York. Why the hell would anyone be dressed like that?
So, enter Ernie Popchick, who is this elderly fellow, who is... I'm pretty sure this is his first appearance, but yeah, he's one of Aunt May's boarders. This is around the time where Aunt May was like a landlady, and she just had a bunch of old dudes living with her. Okay?
Okay, so, yeah. I guess Aunt May took in boarders. You know, I guess that's one of the many, many parts of the Marvel Universe I didn't bother to learn.
Yeah, well, so Ernie says, hey, young whippersnapper Peter, I'm here to cash my pension check and walk up and down Manhattan with a big wad of bills just hanging out of my pocket. And then, of course, the three dudes in Mohawks behind him are like, okay, and then they start mugging him. And so Spider-Man switches into his black spider outfit because this is at post Secret Wars but pre the advent of Venom, so he's just wearing his alien symbiote outfit just like it ain't no thing.
Yep.
And so he's really upset with these muggers, of course, so he beats them damn near to death and gets sort of a stern talking to with the local constabulary. Saying, "Damn it, Spider-Man! You know these leave these kids alive so that they can see their day in court, and they'll probably have Matt Murdock as their lawyer. Because why wouldn't they? BT Dubs, did you hear Jean the Wolf died? Yeah, she was murdered in her sleep. Well, goodbye."
Yeah.
It just sort of, the guy just sort of says that out of nowhere.
He's like, did you hear about Jean DeWolf? And he's like, she's dead. Someone blew her away. And he's like, what? Like, holy crap.
And Spider-Man's, but I just saw her the other day in that evening dress. Fuck, man. And so his day is just ruined. There's an interlude here in which we reveal that, yes, Daredevil is indeed going to be a part of this story. And will indeed be representing the muggers in court. But I'm going to fast forward to a scene where Spidey goes to the police precinct and says, hey, who's investigating the murder of Jean DeWolf? And the cops are still just happy to say, oh, well, you want to catch Detective Stan Carter. He just left in that car. And so Spider-Man basically, like, invades the dude's car in the middle of traffic. And Stan Carter's like, hi, Spider-Man. I'm sure we'll be happy to have your help catching the Jean DeWolf's dastardly murderer. Do you have any idea who it could be? I sure don't. It could be anyone who lives in New York. It could be you, or it could even be me. Wink! So Matt Murdock basically gets all of the muggers off in court, and all the muggers are like, first of all, again, it's their day in court, and they're wearing, like, tank tops and torn jeans.
Yeah.
And the judge is like, well, they don't have any prior convictions, so, this is how it goes in Judge Rosenthal's courtroom. Everybody gets one. You're free to go. And then all the muggers are, like, pelvic thrusting in the air, saying, like, ha-ha, we'll kill you next time, Grandpa! So while Matt Murdock catches up with his old buddy, Judge Rosenthal, he hears a sinister heartbeat emanating from the judge's quarters. So he just cowboys in there and talks to this guy who is wearing a balaclava and wielding a breech-loading double-barreled shotgun. And Matt's like, hi, I'm blind, who are you? And then the guy's like, I am the Sin Eater! Who are you? And Matt Murdock's like, I'm a lawyer. And his Sin Eater's like, well, fuck you then! And then he discharges his shotgun, and there's a brief fracas when Judge Rosenthal, stomps in and says, what's all this then? And then Sin Eater's like, ah, the judge! I will consume your sins! And the issue ends with him blowing the judge the fuck away with a shotgun at point-blank range. That's a motif of all these issues, by the way. That's the final panel of the first three. We're in kind of some serious shit, yo. All courtesy of the writer, which is mentioned in the very end. Yep, your friend and mine, Brendan, Mr. Peter David.
Yeah, I had a feeling it was him.
Brendan has already spoken at length at how disappointed he was with Peter David's hand at the Sensational She-Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
So much so, in fact, that the very next week when I met Peter David at a convention, I actually asked him about it, and Peter David basically said, yeah, I'd never done comedy before, and they gave this assignment to me like 12 hours before it was due. So I just said, put Mary Hart from E.T. in the cab from Who Framed Roger Rabbit in it, and then it was kind of done. So... just, calm your tits, Brendan. But, this, however, while he had written a couple issues beforehand, and actually the very first issue Peter David wrote, I actually spoke to him about it in that interview. Again, that was a Spectacular Spider-Man that was, the story was inspired largely by the real-world murder case of Leopold and Loeb. So, Peter David's kind of a dark dude, really, to come on to Spider-Man, but hey, it was the start of the Iron Age, before we realized just what a complete and colossal waste of time the Iron Age would eventually become. So, honestly, he was kind of fitting right in with the Spectacular Spider-Man, and Death of Jean DeWolf was his first permanent writing gig that he ever landed for Marvel Comics. Cool, huh?
Yeah, I guess so.
So moving on with issue number 108, Matt's pursuing the Sin Eater out into the crowd, and while looking for, dangerous homicidal vigilantes, he naturally passes right by Charles Bronson.
Yeah, I saw that. That's kind of bad.
Okay, I guess, again, Peter David's kind of a pop culture referential sort of dude, which, hey, so am I.
And he's reading a newspaper that says, Vigilante Strikes Again. Oh, God. How many years old was Death Wish? Oh, okay. It was old enough that they made a Death Wish reference in the Iron Man-Spider-Man team-up that started this show.
So Spidey swings in and engages with a Sin Eater. Old Sinny takes a shot, which Spider-Man effortlessly dodges, like, aha, I have the proportional agility of a spider. And then he realizes that the buckshot went into several members of the... several innocent bystanders who were just right the hell there in the middle of this madding crowd, one of whom would later die from his injuries. So this really puts all those Amazing Spider-Man movie scenes in perspective when, like, Spider-Man is fighting the giant rhino mech and there's 100 people crowded around going, woo, spring break!
Yeah. At least this was kind of realistic. You know, he dodges a gunshot and the bullet's got to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's something you don't see all the time.
Just as Spider-Man has the upper hand on the, let's face it, not really super-powered dude in a ski mask, he notices that the Sin-Eater has a predilection towards taking souvenirs from all of his killings.
Mm-hmm.
So he has the judge's gavel in his belt right next to Gene DeWolf's police badge. So Spider-Man's like, the fuck? You must have killed Gene DeWolf. I will end you now. Although Aunt May appears to have been knocked over there, so take care. I better see to her first. And that's how the Sin-Eater escapes. So Matt Murdock, who had just could not find a closet or something to change into for the longest damn time, finally swings onto the scene in his horn-headed regalia, and it is too late to capture the Sin-Eater, although he tries his best to follow his heartbeat. I've read so many Daredevil comics, I mean to actually ask a cardiologist, hey, do individual people have, like, wildly distinct heartbeats from each other? I'm being a range of blood pressures, you know?
Yeah.
I find it really hard to believe that, like, in a crowd of 1,000 people that even Daredevil can single out one person's heartbeat.
I think it was some derpy thing that sounded cool years ago, and he's been doing it for so long they can't unhave him do it. You know, it's like they can't walk that back and go, yeah, this is kind of stupid. He needs a new way to be able to trace people. No, but they just got to go, we've been doing it for 40 years, we're still doing it.
Say true about Frank Miller, I'm pretty sure that he never had Daredevil read a newspaper by just dragging his fingers across the ink.
Duh.
Anyway. So Sin-Eater gets away scot-free because it's the second issue of a 4-issue arc, so obviously he would. And so the next day, Spider-Man reconvenes with your friend and mine, Sergeant San Carter. And so San greets Spider-Man by saying, hey, Spider-Man, do you know what a Sin-Eater is? I sure do! It's a character from some American sects of the Judeo-Christian faith who eat food off corpses and thus absorb their sins. Isn't it funny how I knew that? By the way, I used to be a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent. Yep, Agent Carter, they call me. Not to be confused with, you know, Peggy or Sharon or that other Carter guy from the previous arc. But you know this because you noticed my framed and signed picture of Nick Fury that I keep on my desk.
Who looks more like David Hasselhoff than the Nick Fury that was Skyping into the Wraith's trial. I mean, this guy looks Hasselhoff-y.
I briefly imagined that when people would leave the service of the FBI, would J. Edgar Hoover just give them a signed headshot to remember him by? And then I said to myself, actually, he probably would do that. He was kind of creepy that way. Did I mention that my partner died 6 months ago?
No, I don't believe you did mention your partner died 6 months ago, Officer Carter, former Agent Carter.
So, in summary, I'm this smiling, beatific, benign personality who came out, who was just introduced in this arc, and I'm unloading an extreme amount of backstory upon you for no reason. I'm not the Sin Eater! Wink!
yeah, sure. You're not the likely suspect in a mystery that only has one suspect so far.
Well, to be fair, there is one other suspect, but he is so obviously a red herring. I'm not. I've earmarked him to only be mentioned like 2 issues from now, but we'll get to him. Spidey hits up Jean's apartment to shake it down for clues, and what should he discover? But Gene's secret stash of Spidey memorabilia. I somehow imagine that he, like, stumbled upon, like, a Helga Pataki-style, like, closet shrine built to Spider-Man, but no, that's just my hateful memory playing tricks on me. No, it's just an envelope of, like, photos and newspaper clippings that are on Gene's desk, and Spidey's like, wow, she has a lot of these, even more than that kid who collected Spider-Man and died of leukemia in that really great issue a couple months ago. Spoilers.
Yeah.
And, hey, here's some pictures of me and the Black Cat that Gene has angrily excised the Black Cat from with scissors.
That's not stalkerish at all.
Huh. Well, I'm going to be forgetting I ever saw this. And, yeah, that's this arc's one olive branch extended to the you know, squishy, unrequited love story of Gene DeWolf that, you know, kind of caused this whole murder. I'm glad that Peter David, or more likely the editorial staff who was demanding Peter David write this, at least had the stones to acknowledge that in some way. But naturally, we smash cut from that awkward moment to her funeral. And I do love how these two characters kind of have a spat over the coffin, and I didn't recognize them at first, but it's later revealed. That's Jean's parents. That's
her mother and stepfather, because her stepfather hasn't got that Kaiser Wilhelm mustache that her biological father has.
Does he not have that there?
No, his upper lip is drawn a little weird, but it's not a mustache. Plus, her actual biological father would have been in prison still.
Well, I thought it was him. I thought that looked like him, because we see the stepfather later and he doesn't have that hair.
Really?
But I don't know.
Do we see the stepfather later?
It's much later. You know, you don't need to skip ahead too far just yet. But long story short, I imagined that Papa Philip came to her funeral and said, "Wait, guys, it's okay. I have this method where I could bring her back as a psionic meat puppet." Like, no, Phil. Go back to jail, Phil.
No. Seriously, I bring her back as a psionic meat puppet, then I control her for a while, then we get Dr. Strange to take the bullet out of her chest, and it totally makes her sane again, and it'll work. I've done it once before. Trust me.
But no, obviously the story is way too faux serious, yo, to traffic in that kind of nonsense. Then we smash cut to a confessional at a Catholic church. Sin Eater's like, "Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. It has been since last issue that I last since my last confession that wasn't important enough for Jordan to mention. So I totally shotgunned some dudes to death." And the priest is like, "I don't know. Could you not do that?" And then the Sin Eater's like, "Forgive you, Father, for you have sinned." Bam! End of issue on yet another fatal shotgun blast.
Yep.
Motif established. Issue number 109. There are lots of little vignettes of the public's reaction to this latest Sin Eater killing. There's a setup for that issue that I actually did review 3 or so years ago, involving an evil burglar Santa Claus. Boy, don't you wish you were here for that one? Spider-Man's kind of losing his patience. I'm not sure if I've really illuminated that much through this arc. He is just in an Iron Age-y sort of mood, and he is really letting his fists do the talking.
Well, he's wearing the black suit, so...
This would probably be retconned later that it was, it was Venom, guiding his actions. But anyway, Spidey's strikes on the brilliant goddamn idea to visit a dude who was mentioned on the radio earlier that morning, a low-level drug dealer who had his day in court and was released because the evidence against him was improperly collected. So he's like, he must know who the Sin Eater is. So he shakes this guy down at his house in front of his 6-year-old daughter, then bodily drags him to a gangster bar and says, "Boy, thank you for inviting me, your bestest buddy, Spider-Man, out for this dinner date at this gangster bar. Will you introduce me to your gangster friends? Me, Spider-Man, the superhero?" And it is just this roundabout way to, like, coerce this dude into giving up all his juicy Sin Eater info before he is, fitted for concrete shoes or whatever. And the guy says, "Look, I don't know what the fuck I can tell you, dude. I don't know who the Sin Eater is." And the Spider-Man's like, well, this is time well spent, goodbye. And we just never hear from this guy again. The Sin Eater guy, you know, he's talking about sins and how he has to punish and murder the sinners. And I said to myself, you know what? Seven was a pretty good movie. And it sure was helpful, though, that one part in Seven when the Sin Eater, or when the sin-obsessed villain just kind of showed up at the hero's place of employment. So the Sin Eater just shows up at the Daily Bugle while Peter's there, and he's like, I'm here to kill J. Jonah Jameson. And Joe Robertson actually, like, pretends to be Jameson and risks an immediate shotgun blast to the face, so some stones that old Robbie has, would you say?
Yeah.
But fortunately, Peter Parker, who is secretly the Amazing Spider-Man, is on hand to rip the roller off of a nearby typewriter and throw it across the room into Sin Eater's face and knocks him unconscious instantly. And so they unmask the Sin Eater and gasp! It's old man Emil Gregg! A guy who showed up briefly in the beginning of this arc and I didn't feel the need to mention. Mr. Gregg explains that he's schizophrenic and that he's been hearing voices and they've been filling his head full of, you know, how he has to punish the sinners. And he honestly doesn't remember killing anybody up to this point, but he's pretty sure he did. So he purposely tried to attack Jameson when he was the most offended so that they would catch him. And Spider-Man's like, case closed. And so, of course, Daredevil pops in, listens to his heartbeat, and says, yeah, it's not him. Sorry, the heartbeat doesn't check out. And Spider-Man's like, dude, the story's almost over. What are you doing?
And it's like his gun's the same. It even has the same, you know, dent in it where he clubbed me with it. You know, he does details of the crime someone else does. It's got to be him. He's like, I don't care. It's not him. Can you at least explain to me that you fucking know his heartbeat? Like, we don't need to know that you're blind. Just say, by the way, I have super senses.
I can't reveal my trade secrets with you. Let's just go paw through Greg's apartment. To Greg's apartment. So they're at Greg's apartment. And they're like, hey, what a fun coincidence. Stan Carter lives right next door to this guy. Cool, huh? And in fact, there's a door that connects their two apartments. That's weird. Hey, Stan Carter's closet is full of balaclavas and shotguns. That's weird.
Okay, I've heard of hotel rooms having adjoining rooms. I've never heard of an apartment having an adjoining apartment.
So now it seems that Stan Carter, wink, is actually the Sin Eater. Wink! So they call J. Jonah Jameson's house to say maybe he's circling around to kill him there. And for reasons that I honestly forgot, even though I read this story like 3 times in the last couple days, J.J. is like on vacation or something, so Marla Madison, his new blushing bride, is there house-sitting with Betty Brant, J. Jonah Jameson's secretary and Spider-Man's first girlfriend. And the Sin Eater finds Betty Brant in Jameson's office. And old Sinny's like, close enough. So he unloads his shotgun right through the high-back leather chair where she was sitting. Would you believe that panel that where it looks like Betty Brant just got decapitated by a shotgun blast, would you believe it was a struggle to get that past the censors? In this era where the comics code had almost no authority whatsoever.
And you can't even see her in the chair.
Yeah.
It's literally just the chair getting shot from that angle.
I know that was mentioned in all my research about this, about the Death of Jean DeWolf arc, is that the third issue was very nearly recalled because of that image. Issue 4 begins with Betty Brant having ducked just in time. Yeah. Whatever you say, Magic Comic Book. So, Sin Eater's like, well, it'll take too long to reload, so I guess I'll just garrote you with the gun. And while I'm doing this, may I mention that I murdered the priest because he advocated against the death penalty. And I murdered the judge because he coddled criminal scum. And I murdered Jean DeWolf because...
Yeah, literally, because I felt like it. That's his excuse. That is, I'm quoting, yeah. Because I felt like it.
It would have made more sense if he said, I murdered Jean DeWolf because editorial told me to.
Yeah.
Needless to say, Spider-Man crashes through the window, and the climactic battle between Spider-Man and Sin Eater takes, like, a page.
Yeah, he webs the end of the shotgun.
Probably should have thought of that first.
Then snatches it from him with the web, breaks it over his knee, and then pretty much 1-2 punches him down.
And, of course, he unmasks him and gasps, "It was old man Stan Carter."
Wink?
Wink.
And then he starts beating him up some more. So at this point, I'm like, yeah, Spidey, you hit him a few more times for me because, you know, fuck this story. Although Betty's not taking it as well, watching Spider-Man mm-hmm. nearly beat a man to death.
Mm-hmm. Well, Daredevil comes to pull him off just in time, and there is so much, I call it falling action, even though there actually is one more action beat at the tail end of this issue, but there's just a long, real come down from the story, and I guess it's not, you know, it's natural for it to have that, but there are just many, many other mini vignettes of random New York civilians saying, "Oh, so it was a cop who was the new serial killer. Well, obviously those other cops were covering for him, and you can't trust cops anymore." What else? So more evil Santa Claus. Oh, and here's where Ernie, Ernie Popchick re-enters the story. So, Brendan, I have noticed in my many years of being in your acquaintanceship that you have a strong grasp on history, and I usually can't mention any historical figure, no matter how obscure, and you seize upon it immediately. Do you remember Bernard Goetz?
Yes.
Well, Ernie Popchick gets his Bernard Goetz on.
Yeah. Well, God, yes. He's in the subway. He's
Before you spoil it too much, I do love how Aunt May mentions, she calls Peter. "Peter, I'm worried about Ernie Popchick. He was really angry, and he took his old memento from WW2, his old service revolver, and entered a subway." And then you see him in the subway, and he finds the most passive-aggressive muggers of all time, who just kind of barely threateningly ask him for money, and then Ernie's like, "I can use this!" And he pulls out a fully automatic pistol.
It's supposed to be a service revolver. He pulls out an M1911, Colt 45.
And so he lights up these dudes. And
well, the thing about the Bernard Goetz case, and it's kind of how this plays out, I mean, here these guys are being, they're clearly drawn as muggers, they're acting like muggers, but they're not, you know, they're not brandishing weapons.
Yeah.
In the Bernard Goetz case was that, it wasn't clear if he was being mugged or not. He just shot a bunch of guys mm-hmm. who maybe were threatening, maybe they weren't. It's a matter of perception. Yep. Was his life in danger or was it not? Mm-hmm. And, you know, just like, well, I was on the subway and shot a couple guys.
Yeah, supposedly they had, like, screwdrivers on them, but there was no evidence, even though there were several witnesses, there was no evidence that they were, like, you know, threatening him with the screwdrivers. They just had them because they, you know, steal radios from cars.
It's
tools of trade. The research otherwise lines up pretty well, but the end of Ernie Popchick's story concludes in further issues that I will not be covering, but still you were on point as always, Brendan. Kudos. There's a page in which a bunch of S.H.I.E.L.D. dudes just kind of show up at the precinct and say, "So here's what happened to Stan Carter." So, he was in a division of S.H.I.E.L.D. that was basically the MK Ultra shit that the CIA pulled with experiments with, like, psychotropic drugs. And we tried to make him a super soldier, but it didn't really work. So, he washed out of the program, and our doctors thought they had flushed all those drugs out of his system, but obviously they didn't. So, when his partner was murdered 6 months ago, well, he just went a little nutty, and that's why he put on a balaclava and started jackhammering various public law enforcement figures and J. Jonah Jameson, and manipulated his paranoid schizophrenic neighbor into taking the fall for him. Because, you know, he's insane!
Yeah. I'm not buying it.
Nah, I'm not either. Our story ends with Mylon Stan Carter being moved to Rikers Island. But there's a mob standing in their way, a mob led by Gene DeWolf's stepfather. You know, that kind, gentle soul and a firm believer in the justice system. Yeah, he's the guy who's leading the mob to murder this, murder Carter's ass.
Seems fair.
Seems fair. So Daredevil tries to interpose, but the mob gets a little too strong for him. And Spider-Man, who just had a bit of a row with old Hornhead, is seemingly perfectly fine with leaving him to his fate when Daredevil screams for Peter's help! Peter! And then Spider-Man goes and saves him, and the final page is Daredevil saying, "Yeah, I knew you were Peter Parker because of your heartbeat or whatever. I'm Matt Murdock." This is the sweet dessert that we choke this whole meal down with, is that this forging of this awesome alliance between Spider-Man and Daredevil, and Matt Murdock even agrees to be Ernie Popchick's lawyer, and also kind of sort of hits on Aunt May. The end. This story, the death of Jean DeWolf, is loved by many. It has a really fine trade paperback collection that I've seen on shelves before. And Peter David is often told by fans at conventions that the people really like the story. I don't so much.
I can see where you're coming from with this. I mean, okay, if you're not a fan of Jean DeWolf,
mm-hmm.
then why are you reading it? Because it is, it's a murder mystery that doesn't give you enough suspects or go on long enough for you to develop a theory as to who it might be. So you're left with economy of characters. It has to be the guy investigating it. The explanation as to why he's a villain is kind of a cop-out. Instead of being a rational serial killer like the Punisher, he's batshit crazy, but then he plans things out too well to be batshit crazy.
Mm-hmm.
The art is really good. I'm going to give him that. The art's really good. It changes because they swap anchors a couple of times, and that hurts him a little bit. But otherwise, it's very good. Little bits of detail, like the fact that the drug dealer Spider-Man intimidates has a Coke spoon around his neck. There's some aspects of the story that aren't bad, but when you take it as a whole, it falls down. There's potential for a really good story here.
Well,
but it just seems squandered in places.
I will revisit that point, but real quick, a digression to what I mentioned before. I remember Captain George Stacy.
Yes.
Spider-Man's previous police captain friend.
Yeah.
When Stan Lee decided to kill him off due to his overly familial relationship with Peter, Spider-Man was dueling with Dr. Octopus, that tentacle bastard again, and Doc swings wildly and, collapses a building that would have crushed a child if not for George Stacy to be there to push the kid out of the way and take the fatal blow for himself. And while he's dying, Spider-Man visits him, and Captain Stacy admits he's always known that was Peter under that stocking. Please be good to Gwen while I'm gone. Blurg.
Yeah.
Which was a, bittersweet and real heartrending, but also heroic exit for that character.
Yeah.
Which... again, the Amazing Spider-Man movie is completely screwed up by having George Stacy say, "Stay the fuck away from my daughter, blarg," and then Peter's like, "Fuck that!" So, of course, they break up like 10 minutes into the next movie. I don't miss those films at all, really. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is that, obviously George Stacy's passing was fairly considered, and he went out like a hero. So, when Spider-Man's backup police captain friend, when the order from on high comes to knock her the fuck off, with that added just icky romance angle, they're like, let's just hollow out her stomach cavity off screen while she gets murdered in her sleep. That's how she goes out. And I know it's the Iron Age now, so, things are faux serious, yo.
We're all grimdark here in this grimdarkness.
I have seen, I hate to play this card, but I have seen so many female characters just get erased because their characters have become problematic for future writers. And instead of, fixing it, having the writers, resolve that ugly issue, who cares? They're just chicks. Let's just kill them. Kevin Smith thought so when he started writing Daredevil. It's like, no one likes Karen Page anymore now that she's like a porn star or whatever, so let's just murder her. Even though honestly, her being a porn star would seem to be way more into Kevin Smith's wheelhouse.
Yeah, also but, the fact that she's a porn star could play into Matt's Catholic guilt. I mean, holy crap, come on, guys. Mm-hmm. There's exactly two characters in the Marvel Universe who wear their Catholicism on their sleeve. One of them became a priest, and he's bright blue, and the other one is Daredevil.
And the other one looks like an actual devil.
Yeah. You know, it's like, it always strikes me as a remarkably petty, not just petty, but unprofessional thing to do. For a writer to go, I don't know what to do with this character, I'll kill him off. That's showing that you're a bad writer. Because if you don't know what to do with him, don't write a story with him in it.
It wasn't Peter David's fault. In my research, it was the editor, whose name, by the way, is Jim Owsley. So, is this like Leland's brother who's getting revenge on... there are so many cute coincidences between, you know, along the story. Like, you know how Gene DeWolf's story began with Daredevil and then a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent named Carter? And it ended with Daredevil and a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent named Carter.
Yeah, I won't blame Peter David for killing Gene DeWolf, because I know how much damage an editor can do. Mm-hmm. Hi, Joey Q.
Yeah,
I
found some interviews with him where he said that he came to the table with the Sin Eater storyline. He came up with a gritty, realistic, crazed serial killer who is taking out law enforcement officials. And Gene DeWolf was a part of that story, and she was the one who actually first figured out that Stan Carter was the Sin Eater. That was the original script. Peter David says he really liked the character Gene DeWolf and had plans to use her more often in, you know, during his run. But Jim Owens was like, we can't have her getting weak-kneed over Spider-Man, so just off her. I shed tears when Gene DeWolf died. And I'm clearly not the only one, because there have been, you know, all throughout the 80s, there were movements to bring her back, because it's comics and people come back from death all the goddamn time. But that never happened. But in so many other incarnations of the Marvel Comic Universe and other media, they almost always find a place for Jean the Wolf. The next time I saw her was, if Marvel Team Up was the last place I expected good things to come from, well, I was enjoying the second to last place where I expected good things to come from, the Spider-Man 3 video game. Which was a horrific follow-up to not only one of the best Spider-Man movies, but also one of the best Spider-Man video games. If Spider-Man 3 was self-aware and listening to this podcast, I'm sure he'd be saying to himself, oh, thank God Jordan's on hiatus from his video game podcasts. And I would say, yeah, you're lucky, man. You are so lucky. I don't have time to get in to the god-awful narrative of that video game, but there is a major side quest of sorts in which Spider-Man teams up with Police Sergeant Gene DeWolf, who is ferreting out a conspiracy of corrupt cops. And it ends with a final showdown with the main corrupt cop, who very nearly murders Gene DeWolf with a breech-loading double-barreled shotgun. But thankfully, things work out differently in the video game. Hooray.
Yeah.
In my research, I later discovered that she was a major fixture in the Ultimate Spider-Man, the Ultimate Comics Universe. And if there is a motto to the Ultimate Comics Universe, it would be, hey guys, remember this thing that was ruined in the original Marvel Comics Universe? Well, you see us ruin it! So, it was revealed that Captain Gene DeWolf was a corrupt mole for the Kingpins organization. You'll never guess why she decided to betray the S.H.I.E.L.D. For the Kingpin. Guess.
Ultimate Universe?
Mm-hmm.
Money's too easy. Sex. She wanted the Kingpin.
Yeah. Once again, she falls madly in love with the supervillain, and it was apparently much more requited in this one, because after she's murdered, Kingpin. I saw panels of this. Kingpin bawls like a baby when he hears that she was killed. She was just really good in the sack, man. Thanks, Ultimate Universe. The Ultimate Universe. If you don't remember anything other than Miles Morales or the Samuel L. Jackson Nick Fury, good.
Yep. I'm so glad they never got around to butchering She-Hulk by putting her in the Marvel, the Ultimates universe.
Mm-hmm. I don't recall seeing her, so yeah, good for them.
I'm so glad they never got around to that.
I don't know about you, but since it came out free on the PlayStation 4, I've been enjoying Marvel Heroes Omega, which is basically the Marvel Universe Diablo, not the Fantastic Four evil Spanish guy, the video game Diablo. But yeah, so Jean DeWolf is in that, and she's suspected as being a dirty cop. Oh no, but it's revealed that she stumbled upon the Kingpin's warehouse, and there were three thugs who were beating Speedball of the New Warriors. He was lashed to a chair, and they were just punching the shit out of Speedball. And
does that work?
I was about to say, he has, kinetic absorption and redirection powers.
Really, does that work?
Punching him just kind of makes him stronger.
Yeah.
But apparently the writers of Marvel Diablo didn't care enough about Speedball to read that. So Jean's like, not on my watch, motherfucker. And then she shoots the three dudes. But then it's the Kingpin's warehouse, so he had a secret camera. So he's like, haha, I have proof that you're a murderer, Captain Jean DeWolf. So you're going to work for me now. And I'm like, as a video game protagonist, I've killed, 20,000 dudes. I guess superheroes just really benefit from not having as much, not having as much oversight as actual deputized police officers do.
Yep.
Jeez. So,
Captain DeWolf shot three dudes. Can we compare my body count?
That was kind of fun. Hey, while Spectacular Spider-Man the comic was basically spelled the death of her, Spectacular Spider-Man, the animated television show from 2008, it had her as a uniformed beat cop who was constantly commenting on Spider-Man's usual shenanigans alongside her partner, Smilin' Stan Carter. nothing ever really became of these characters, although I can only imagine in the prospect of third season. Actually, I don't want to think about that.
Yeah. It won't go anywhere happy.
There's so many reasons why that show should have survived, but the resolution of DeWolf and Carter's partnership, I'm a little afraid.
It was probably going to end badly.
And last but not least, the most recent place that I've seen Captain Jean DeWolf is in that alternate universe that is nothing if not a haven for Spider-Man supporting characters who have been killed in the main universe, that being Spider-Gwen's home universe, where Gwen Stacy and Captain George Stacy and Jean DeWolf are all working together to fight the good fight because Peter Parker turned into, the Lizard or some shit and then died. Fair's fair, right?
So it seems like everyone likes Captain DeWolf except Jim Owsley. I think that's the takeaway from this.
Mm-hmm. You know, ultimately, I guess I got my wish. Look, I have my issues with the Spider-Gwen comic, and I'm not completely up to date on it. But hey, I'm seeing Jean DeWolf, kicking ass on the beat in seemingly another Marvel universe, so who am I to complain, right?
She's still hanging around in some form.
Mm-hmm. Hats off to you, ma'am. I'm just glad to see that there is still DeWolf Among Us. I'm sorry, I had to squeeze the title in somehow. So, on that note, we should probably be moving on. But hey, we still got just the barest amount of time on the clock. You know, it is extremely tempting to comment on the vast plethora of news about comic book inspired movies and the great big blockbusters. Admittedly, I feel like, that you and I could just go blue in the face just, talking about, trailers and all the news from San Diego Comic-Con and D23 last. And I see so many people who get a lot of footage out of this. I just feel like it's kind of an empty gesture, really. I'd much rather wait to comment on the movie itself when it comes out. We could really get some meaty conversation out of that, right?
Yeah.
But there is just one little bit of news item, one small news item that I got to comment on. It is kind of interesting that, in the last episode of our previous show was our Wonder Woman spectacular. And I bitched quite long and loud about Ares at the end of that movie and his ridiculously tweedy mustache. Like, that's not a mustache very well befitting of, you know, the Greek god of Lord of War. I really feel like he should have, like, I don't know, shapeshifted or something. Like, David Thewlis is a cool guy and all, spoilers. But anyway, I probably said to myself, hey, there's no possible way that we could have a sillier incident in the DCEU involving mustaches. Boy, was I wrong. So, there's going to be some reshoots for the Justice League movie. Probably involving Henry Cavill, so, you know, Superman's gonna come back to life in this Justice League movie. Spoilers, I guess. And
we
unfortunately,
all
kind of
figured he was coming back.
Unfortunately, he's still on the set of Mission Impossible 6, where I don't know much about his role, except for the fact that he may as well be playing a character known as The Mustache, because, my God, is it important that he have this immaculately huge, styled, waxed mustache. And he can't possibly get rid of that, shave that off, for fear of interfering with, you know, the non-DCEU movie that he's committed to. So, the decision was made to laboriously CGI out his mustache for his scenes in Justice League.
We need to do some reshoots, Henry. That's okay, but I'm not shaving the stash off, because I really like it. It makes me feel like a man. Henry Cavill's actually British, so I'm doing the accent.
Almost all American superheroes are British.
Yeah. We need to do reshoots, Henry. Superman doesn't have a mustache. Well, he's bloody well going to have a mustache now. Okay, we're going to CGI this shit out.
I should have committed to memory the fine fellow on YouTube who gave us a supercut of all of Superman scenes from BVS. With a fancy CGI mustache. And in his angry scene where he has his glowing red angry eyes, he has an adjoining angry red glowing mustache.
I gotta go look for this.
It gets better. Then we get to Wonder Woman's grand entrance, and when she unfolds her bracer-clad arms, she also has a mustache. So when mustachioed Superman asks Batman, "Is she with you?" Batman responds back, "I thought she was with you." That line has never made more sense.
Oh, I need to spend more time on YouTube.
So, yeah, I guess that'll do it for your third visit to the Nonstop Comic Shop. Thank you very much for tuning in. And, you know, tune in 2 weeks for your next visit. So, for my colleague Brendan Michelli, I am Jordan Hazelwood. And I guess we'll catch you next time at the Nonstop Comic Shop, where we will always have issues.
Drive safe, everyone.
You know, also had a weird mustache? Cesar Romero.
Yeah, he painted over his, too.
For more podcasts at least as nerdy as this one, go to GeekAid.com. GeekAid. It's spelled like a sports drink, not like an adhesive bandage.